Welcome to this week's edition of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, here in the studio with our skeletal team.
The core members.
Yes. Ted.
You're down to the femur.
Being a new again dad, not here. Mott on vacation, not here. Me leaving tomorrow, praise God, but it's all good. But I do have Steve and Candace here in the studio, and they are good to go. And we are going to start out by talking about summer sports. And I enjoy the idea of talking about this because, as I've said before, I understand sports that don't involve professional team aspects to them, like the traditional ones.
You like baseball. Unprofessional teams?
I like unprofessional teams or sports where you're just out there and it's just you and you don't have to worry about teamwork.
I am so with you, Lisa.
An individualist.
That is beautiful, Lisa.
That is just such a Christian principle. Let's
just downright
put that.
American.
Find a corresponding scripture, someone, please. So, but we're in a summer of the Olympics in China, which is awesome.
Except that they're talking about how they're not going to be able to breathe because it's so polluted.
That's true.
I mean, talk about performance disenhancers.
Yeah, but they're spending apparently like millions bringing plants in. So I think they're trying to sift it out with some natural remedies.
And if that doesn't
plants
work,
and flowers.
They can just do their sports with the oxygen mask on.
Well,
it just
Michael
reminds
Jackson.
Me of the 96 Olympics that were in Atlanta. And the Atlanta committee had sold their location by saying that it's usually not that hot in July in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, horses fainting and other people obviously struggling with the heat.
Yeah, that is not helpful. So what's your summer Olympic sport that you watch?
Gymnastics.
Yeah, that is fun.
Love the stories. Don't you love the stories, Steve?
See, that's the thing. We always joke about that.
14-year-olds who've fought the odds.
Well, especially because when it is the individual versus the team, it's so easy for them to go come up with these stories. Mm-hmm. The thing that we always notice, though, is how depressing some of those stories can be because they're presenting it as if, oh my gosh, it's so exciting that this child started training in utero. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they got him out of the maternity ward, they were working them into this balancing system. And, you know, every year in the 5 seconds that they get to check in with their family, they're telling them how great it is that they're learning. And you hear these stories and you think, I sure hope they win the gold after giving every ounce of their life for this gold. Actually, our favorite stories are the people who just kind of back their way into a sport and still have this full and productive life on the
Eddie
side.
Eddie the Eagle, the guy who couldn't swim, or what was that?
No, those are the good stories. No, wasn't he the downhill skier?
Oh, yeah. Well, you remember the guy that couldn't swim and he ended up on the swim team and they had to pretty much save him from drowning in the pool. And,
Yeah.
See, those are the best.
Well,
stories.
I've always thought that I could do crew. Like, in fact, I remember when, this was probably 10 years ago, my roommates and I were sitting around with a big bag of Oreos watching the Olympics.
It was so appropriate.
And trying to decide which Olympic sport we could feasibly compete in within 4 years.
Did you lay the Oreos out so they're like the Olympic logo?
Oh, no. We just gobbled them up like mad women. No, we were sitting there and we just figured it would be crew because there's not, and I'm sorry if anyone out there does crew, but it doesn't appear that there's a lot of skill. You just need to be super buff and be synchronized. So we figured that we knew one another well enough.
Lisa has now offended another segment.
No, but I mean, you do have
audience.
To be like super buff. I mean, you have to know what you're doing and you have to be well trained and athletic and stuff and be able to, you know, be in the sun without getting skin cancer.
I'm fairly certain that the Morkans have a son who did crew. You know, we talk about the Morkans all the time, so we're probably going to hear about this.
We'll hear from him.
About how wrong Lisa is about the whole skill issue.
Well, and then there's the Tour de France that's going on. That's another elite sport that just, you know, a lot of snobby people watch.
And guys who are willing to shave their legs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and they've got to compete with the whole image of the doping scandal, and they've got to show that they do have a lot of great athletes who don't use performance-enhancing chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trying to get their reputation untarnished.
Mm-hmm. And that's not a sport that normal people can do. So I just can't even identify with it. The whole climbing the Pyrenees or whatever it is. And Lance Armstrong, his lung capacity is something inhuman. And I just balk at that. I don't appreciate people who aren't normal.
Yeah. Well, which is why the other sporting event of the summer more people can relate to is the camping out in the tents waiting for new movie releases of the summer.
That is a big one that you guys were saying you saw over in your neighborhood. That's happening already for Dark Knight?
Yeah, actually not in our neighborhood.
Oh, not.
But down the road a bit.
Sorry.
At the theater. Mm-hmm. We were there, what, I think 3 weeks ago for a film. And I went back with our daughter to see the American Girl movie, which was so awesome. And the same guys were in the tents with a countdown sign on the brick that said 4 more days. And I'm thinking, thank God, in 4 days they can get showers. I mean, it's not like the theater is providing, you know, amenities for these. What do they do?
Well, I think the theater does occasionally provide, or often provide, free food for them.
Because
they've gotten such...
And Sour
really
Patch
Kids.
Do you
really need anything else? Goodness, I mean, popcorn and hot dogs, whatever. But yeah, they run their own website apparently and do all kinds of movie updates specifically for it's the comic book releases that they're specifically hardcore
is this
about.
National?
The guys that I know. Well, the guys here that I know are just local, but they've gotten a lot of national attention. But people are
single,
doing it.
I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. Single guys.
Yeah, they're single.
Well, Candace thought of them again because watching Kit Kittredge, they've got a hobo town, right?
That's right. There were a lot of similarities.
Nice.
Actually, the hobos seem to have their act a little bit more together than the guys in the tents. Sorry, guys, but, you know, three, 4 weeks, don't you have jobs? Don't you have...
Well,
you
but
know,
that's their job, right?
They've
got, they found a way to make money on this, right? Some of them.
Who's watering their
yeah,
house plants?
They run a website.
Their house
plants.
They
don't have house plants. They don't have homes. They just live in tents at various movie theaters. So, well, maybe we'll have to find them. Maybe we'll have to do a remote interview
well,
with
I was
them
thinking
at some point.
That would be ideal. Lisa, you can go down and talk to these guys. Single guys, Lisa.
I know. There's an opportunity there. Well, I will do that and we'll report back when we get the opportunity about the men in tents.
I'm standing at the edge of something beautiful, but now dreamy are the eyes through which I see. I tiptoe this borderline and feel the rain through the sunshine. I'm balancing apathy and dreams. So speak, speak to me now. I'm just about to go to bed and rest my weary soul now for a while. So speak, speak to me now. The candle's burning out. It's almost time to say.
Well, okay, one thing I think we see in the illustration of the men camping out in front of theaters, as well as maybe some of these other sports, is the power of community and of friendship. And look at, they're doing something together. And for today's roundtable, we want to talk about friendship, and specifically friendship as it applies to us singles, single young adults, and what that looks like. And I think there are a lot of qualities, there are a lot of questions that... that would maybe come up because, you know, people tend to think, oh, friendship, you know, that's a no-brainer. I have my friends. But it ends up being the topic of conversation with a lot of my friends and myself as we're just talking about life in general. You'll remember last week when we talked about when Candace addressed a question from a listener who was basically wondering how to maneuver a friendship with her best friend when both of them may be interested in the same guy. And so there are a lot of things that can play into that. So with Candace and Steve here with me in the studio, let's just start out by asking a general question. How is there any difference between what friendships among single people look like, you think, with friendships with married people? Because you, Candace, said, you know, hello, the best friend. You know, you're supposed to be looking for your best friend as a spouse. So what do? You just cut off the single girlfriend?
You know, I think the hardest transition for single friends are when they start matching up with their future spouses, because it's hard not to feel offended and jilted when the person you used to spend the bulk of your free time with is now wanting to be with this guy. Mm-hmm. And whether you're the one dating who is letting her friends down, or the one doing the dating who can't think of anything but being with the guy, it's just a tough transition. You can't get around the fact that getting married changes how you have friendships with other women. They'll be changed by your changes in life stage, because once you start having babies, suddenly you'll gravitate more toward other moms. Because, you know, as much as your interests change when one's married and one's single, they really change when one's single and one has a baby. Mm-hmm. So I think, but it's appropriate as you move into that new life phase that what you need from a friendship and what you're able to give to a friendship will change. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most interesting aspects right now is the concept of the urban tribe. It was a book by Ethan Waters, no relation, that came out a few years back. And he talks about how we've always had this this progression in our lives. Friends we make in high school, friends around our neighborhood, then friends you make in college. And then typically, when the average age of getting married was around 22, people would get married and then maybe occasionally keep up with some of those friends from college, especially if they ended up in the same town and started moving into different life stages together. But what's happening now is that as people delay when they get married, those friendships from college take on a different life. And then maybe they add on top of those friendships from college new friendships from the workplace, and then they share those friends in the workplace. And then actually, even beyond the urban tribes is the phenomenon of people reengaging through social networks so that relationships that had become dormant from college are reawakened and people are staying connected with those relationships that otherwise they would have moved on from and maybe developed new friendships. Mm-hmm. The problem in all that is figuring out who really are the close friends. Because what we now have is a larger network of fairly sometimes superficial friendships. And there's another survey that came out that said the number of people we can really count on in an emergency or that you know this person's always going to be there for you has dropped over the past 30 years. And so it's the whole phenomenon of 60 friends on Facebook and only one person maybe that you could count on if your car got stuck in a ditch.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I was, you know, a while back when I was in junior high, high school, college. I was the person of the disposable friendship. So I had my friends for different life stages. And as soon as I moved into a different stage, I just moved on to a new set of friends. And it wasn't until I moved here and started developing a few friendships, primarily with women who, you know, we're kind of in it to win it. And they kind of came after me and they're like, look, you know, you need to make it through a quarrel with me, you know, and still be friends at the end. And that was just like news to me. You know, I was just like, you just decided you didn't like someone anymore and you just moved on. So what does that look like? Establishing healthy friendships, especially as people are starting to marry later and later. And then how too, you both can address this. How do you keep that from getting into some weird boundary issues where ultimately you're so tied to that person that my goodness, to extricate yourself and never get married is going to be difficult.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the point about disagreeing over something. I think back and the friends that I had in college and right after college, the ones I respected the most were those who were willing to push back and to disagree and ask tough questions and not just be a go-along to get along kind of person. I always looked up to that, and I was actually drawn to someone who would be willing to respectfully disagree. And that's the kind of thing I think is probably most missing in those superficial friendships is the idea of this is a friendship of convenience. We both happen to like certain movies or, you know, certain kinds of entertainment. But if push comes to shove, if we really had to get into stuff that matters, we'd find out that we don't have anything in common.
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings up the issue of intentionality, which anybody who's listened to the show for any amount of time or who's read Boundless knows we're a big fan of intentionality. And I think we should be as intentional about our platonic friendships as we are about other relationships in our lives, be it with our parents or pastor or boyfriend, girlfriend, and eventually spouses, that there is this sense, I think, in high school and even in college and beyond, that friendships are about entertainment. Mm-hmm. And as you move on in life and start to get married and have kids, I think friendships need to be more about community. You know, you alluded to community, Lisa, and there's a difference between walking in friendship in a body of Christ mentality, where you're really supporting one another, bearing one another's burdens, challenging one another toward greater spiritual maturity. There's a difference between that and friendships for the sake of, like you mentioned, Steve, going to the same shows, like in the same concerts, you know, having the same songs on your iPod. And that the entertainment friendships really have a harder time weathering the hardships of life. Mm-hmm. And as you get older, you tend to have more hardships and more challenges and more stretching experiences. But also, the friendships that are based around entertainment don't seem to weather limitations that naturally come out of being more committed as you get older and shoulder more responsibility. And I think, you know, I have less time for my female friends now that I have kids. Mm-hmm. And it's okay, though, because they have less time, too. And because our friendships are built on that idea of mutual support within the body of Christ, we have a lot of grace for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you know, it reminds me, too, of the whole concept of if we are to biblically apply the concept of iron sharpening iron, you have to be willing to do that. You have to get into that. You know, that's where some of the messiness comes in, too, that, you know, again, you're probably going to see and implement and be able to work through more in a marriage than, you know, as a single person. Mm-hmm. You're going to have that person who's willing to come up and start talking to you about some stuff, because you want to be able to grow, not only in the friendship, but as a person, too. So that person who really can tell you some hard things and still walk through them with you and come out on the other side and still say, you know, hey, I still love you as a friend, but, you know, we were able to weather this. One thing I wanted to ask you, Steve, let's talk a little bit about, I just have many guy friends who say it's so difficult to establish friendships as guys. And, you know, it's kind of like they'll get together and just watch a game or something and nothing, you know, some of them will lament, nothing deep is ever said. I don't know. I've hung out with these guys for like 7 years. I don't know any of them. What is that phenomenon and how do you get past it?
Well, one thing is the point that Mott's made a couple of times, which is there's such a fear in our culture about being perceived as a homosexual, mm-hmm. if you have a meaningful friendship with a guy, that it keeps people from experiencing some of the deep, meaningful guy-to-guy relationships that, you know, we read about in classic literature in the Bible, that we recognize that before there was that hovering perception of fear of being tagged a homosexual, guys really had some pretty meaningful, intense friendships. And a lot of that was forged in battles, in, you know, shared pursuits and work and things like that. I think getting back to the concept of a friendship that's built around entertainment, you don't have the opportunity to go but so deep when all you're really talking about is that piece of entertainment at hand. You can only say so much about a movie, about the characters and things like that, or playing video games together or something like that. I think we are missing something if it's not built around some kind of pursuit. You know, the guys who have friendships that grew out of the military, that grew out of sports endeavors and business, shared business ventures, typically do have a different depth because they face risk and challenges and have more war stories, if you will, to fall back on. But like I said, I think a lot of it does come back to that fear of being tagged homosexual because they don't know what is healthy. Mm-hmm. What is a healthy connection with a guy?
Mm-hmm. I just have to allude back to your chat comment about team sports. This reminds me that men and women are so different in their friendship, that team sports are an essential part of many young men's development into grown men for this reason Steve's talking about, that it gives them something to bond over that isn't weird.
Well, and two, I think Emerson Eggerich makes a good point that women are more face-to-face in their friendships, and guys are a lot more shoulder-to-shoulder. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of them sitting side-by-side and talking. And he pointed out some study where they had all these different pairings of young girls and guys, and the most substantive conversation came out of two teenage boys who were just sitting in a room in chairs, sitting side by side, shoulder to shoulder, but talking about some of the most meaningful material. Mm-hmm. And so just because they're not face-to-face at a Starbucks and what women might define as a deep, meaningful relationship doesn't mean that they're not having a meaningful connection.
You know, this brings up a good point about the power of questions and being the one in a friendship, whether you're a man or a woman, to ask questions, probing questions, questions that create opportunities for deeper conversations, and really getting into the habit of practicing godliness within your friendships. That will help make the transition into friendships post-marriage easier. You know, we have this phenomenon of later marriage, and so many singles have at least a decade of practice at being friends. And I would just encourage those listening to practice habits that will still be appropriate once you're married. So not gossiping about others, because the tendency then once you're married is to get together with your girlfriends and talk about what slackers your husbands are. And that's so unhelpful for the marriage relationship, because you want your friendships to reinforce the relationships in the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of one of my really good friends. He is married, and I'm friends with both she and her husband. But I remember telling her at one point how you know, I just said, you know, I really want to join with you or be part of helping you fight for your marriage and be a part. And so, you know, call me when you need babysitting, when you guys need to go do something, when you need, you know, when you want to talk with me, and I will do my best to, you know, build him up and you both, you know, in front of one another. And, you know, I think single people can kind of get involved in helping be a part of, you know, a healthy marriage and encouraging married people as they're married. Cause I think a lot of times they feel like, or so they tell me, they feel left behind, you know, like, oh, the single people, all my single friends are still out having fun and doing this and that. And we're, you know, they just kind of get discouraged, I guess, in kind of what becomes daily life. And so I think it's great to be able to reach out to them and say, you know, hey, I still want to do something with you. I still want to do, you know, I don't feel like you've been pulled into this marriage vortex, you know, and you'll never return.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you know, may feel that
way. Well, it's funny you brought that up, because in that Urban Tribes book, he talks about the phenomenon of people within the circle of friends, these urban tribes, who have friendships where they begin to say, wow, who needs family? Because this group is so tight and we're always there for each other, and who needs to get married? And they said that in some of these groups, they were actually seeing people who would begin to date, especially somebody outside of the group, where the group would feel threatened by this new person, because they felt like if they got married, they would leave the group. Mm-hmm. And so you even had, in some tight circles of friends, people cannibalizing relationships because they didn't want to see their best friend pulled away in marriage and not be a part of this group anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's bordering on unhealthy.
It happens. I've seen it happen.
And so to that end, I would want to remind people that God did ordain friendships, and he created us as humans very different from animals. I mean, you don't see animals buddying around, you know, like humans do. Obviously, God designed something special in a friendship relationship. But you can't have unhealthy expectations of a friendship, because there were some things that God did design family for. And even though friends have made up some of the things they might be missing in family, it's kind of unhealthy to have that expectation that they will, because I think that's an easy way to be disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, those are good thoughts. Yeah, I think it's true that just it definitely you can't give all your time to everyone. You can't spread yourself too thin, and you shouldn't, you know, in an unhealthy way becoming too deep, I guess, with any one person. And so it's just, yeah, it's kind of a dynamic that's interesting to figure out. So, all right. Well, thanks, you two, for weighing in on this. So.
You're welcome.
I have despised my crown. I chose to place it down. Running to catch the wind. Feet bruised and blistered now. From chasing shadows around. A maze of empty promises. Am I still within your view? Have I gone too far for you? To come to me.
For today's culture segment, I have with me in the studio Kevin DeYoung. He is the co-author of a book that is out now called Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be. And welcome, Kevin.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Now, you are also, in addition to being an author, this is an interesting book. First of all, it's an interesting title, and the topic is going to be fascinating for our listeners. We've touched on the emergent church a little bit already, mm-hmm. on the podcast, but you are also a pastor. Kevin is the senior pastor at University Reformed Church in East Lansing, Michigan. How long have you been there?
I've been there just finishing up my fourth year. Yeah, right there in East Lansing. It's right across the street from Michigan State University with 45,000 students. Unfortunately, they don't all go to our church, but some of them...
At least half of them do.
Well, sure, at least half of them, the good ones. But some of them do. So we're not... isolated from the culture. We're right there. Students, postmodern kind of milieu, we're right there, and we're trying to preach the gospel, old school.
Okay. Which is good. That's a good lead into what we're going to talk about, because I will say that Kevin is not looking very pastorish today. He mm-hmm. came sporting the a shirt and shorts and is just being uber cash.
This is my vacation look. I'm growing out a goatee. No one in my church would believe that I can grow facial hair, but
okay.
I'm working on it just while I'm out here in Colorado, trying to look the mountain man, rugged John Eldridge part.
Okay. Well, this will test. We can have a hypothesis as to if things, you know, grow faster in Colorado or
yeah,
something. We'll
yeah.
see the altitude, if that helps. But let's just kind of throw this down or throw this out there. You're basically saying in this book, and you've written it with Ted Kluck, who has written for many different things, including ESPN. He currently writes for Sports Spectrum, has done a lot of stuff. So you guys are saying that basically people who are, you know, in our demographic, young mm-hmm. adults who are looking for churches, and those who particularly are in ministry and in pastorates and in leadership within the evangelical world, you can be relevant. You can be, you know, you can identify with the culture. You can understand a postmodern world, but you can still be a rock solid evangelical. You don't have to become an emergent, is what you're saying. Explain a little bit about how this, really how the book itself came about and how you guys came to that conclusion.
Sure. Yeah. Ted is a member at my church. And like you said, he's written for a number of sports related things. He's a sports writer by trade. And then he got into writing some Christian books through working on this emergent thing with me. So he'd be the first to tell you he's the last guy who thought he'd write a book like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did a book on Mike Tyson, and he always says he'd rather interview Mike Tyson than deal with Christians who get upset about things. So
Is Mike Tyson an emergent?
Probably not.
Okay, not so much. Just checking.
Yeah. So, you know, Ted's the quote-unquote average guy in the pew, or in our case, the really uncomfortable yellow plastic chairs that we have in our church. And so the two of us teamed up to work on this, mostly because our church had a interim period before I came of about 2 years. They had one pastor before that who was there for 36 years, a real solid guy. And then before I came, stuff was just all up in the air. And the Brian McLaren books started getting dog-eared and passed around. And there was kind of a little emergent cohort that was forming. And so when I came, had to really get caught up to speed. What is this? What is it about? And Ted even more looks the part of the emergent church. He's got the cool black glasses and wears a little beret, which I don't understand why he wears that, but he wears that sometimes. And he's into movies
because
and literature.
Because he was a big fan of the Madeline books when he was younger.
Yeah, maybe the Madeline books with his 5-year-old son. But, you know, he was drawn to some of the cultural elements, and he went through a church is lame kind of phase. But to his credit, he had enough discernment to realize that this is not just a style thing. I mean, that's part of it. You know, we talk about the 3 C's, coffee, candles, couches. That's some of it. But it really goes deeper than that. And so the more we read, we both got concerned, me from a pastoral angle, him from, you know, the guy in the pew, saying this is not just doing church with a little different style. This is really going deeper to question some core doctrines. And like you said at the outset, you know, evangelicals, I think we're notorious for always chasing relevance. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like a dog chasing its tail. We're always just spinning around. How can we be cool? How can we be hip? You know, I promise you, there's not a single college student in our church, and we have maybe 100 of them out of 400 people. We're not a big church, but there's not a single student there who comes to our church because I know anything about The Matrix or American Idol or Coldplay or Moby or, I mean, I'm just throwing out those names. I don't know what those things are for the most part, but I've heard of them. I mean, people come
America's Next Top Model.
Yeah,
just
right.
Just thought I'd put that there. Okay.
I mean, people want to know about Jesus, and so that's how we try to be relevant, by giving them the gospel.
Okay. Now your church is generally doctrinally pretty reformed. So how do you, that seems to be a little bit of a whiplash, because a lot of people will traditionally think reformed, these dudes are going to be in robes, you're going to hear the organ, you're going to be, so how do you really, what does your service look like, and how do you stay with the doctrine and the scriptures as primary?
Yeah, we are a reformed church, and we never really went through much of the worship wars, I think because the church was started in the 60s and 70s with probably a lot of Christian hippies to begin with. Mm-hmm. So there's always been, you know, guitars and drums, and we don't get hung up about that. And sometimes we have an organ and we try to do some liturgy type things, and we try to do some more free flowing type things. So I don't know how it all works together, but you know, we're not the traditional wearing robes and the Genevan tabs and, mm-hmm. and cranking out a full organ, though I like the organ. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we do is we have a pretty well-developed, no thanks to me, it was there before I got here, but a pretty well-developed college ministry. We have some full-time staff that do college ministry, and we just have a lot of families that like people. I mean, mm-hmm. I think if you preach the gospel and you actually like people, and that's where, you know, sorry, Reformed folks, but sometimes you got the gospel right, but you don't even like people. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you do that, people will come and you get into people's homes and you share a meal with them and you show some hospitality. And so hopefully we do some of those things well so that these college students stick. And especially at that age, young people, they're just sponges. They really want to learn. And that's maybe some of the attraction of the Emergent Church. To their mm-hmm. credit, they are sort of asking hard questions. They're not just giving, you know, typical evangelical pablum and, you know, don't ask that and move on. But we're trying to do it, and so are a lot of other churches. We're not the only ones, but do it from a confessional standpoint, historic evangelical orthodoxy, and people eat it up. If you love them and you give it to them straight up, I think that's what young people want to hear.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that that's maybe where some of the tension is, that there is the lure of the coffee, candles, couches, and a lot of folks are using, you know, they're kind of using that or expecting that to draw people in, make them feel welcome, especially ones who maybe haven't been as churched or have become disenfranchised. So how do you really, is there a tension for you in that? Do you kind of always feel yourself, I don't know, being pulled back to that? Or why do you think churches that do attract a younger crowd are constantly pulled back to this emergence? Or
yeah, like I said at the beginning, it is, there's really the emergent that's the style thing, the coffee, candles, couches. Then there's emergent that goes a lot deeper. And sometimes the two overlap. But I mean, the last thing I want is somebody listening to this to freak out because, you know, someone lit a wick in your church mm-hmm. or something, and you're, mm-hmm. I mean, that's okay. I mean, that's not what is going to be building up God's kingdom or the church. But if you want to do that, that's fine. You know, what we've found is, you know, I grew up in Grand Rapids, which is an hour and a half down the road, one of these evangelical meccas. And Rob Bell's church, Mars Hill, is mm-hmm. there, 10,000 people. And Bell, I've heard him preach a number of times, and sometimes it's good, and sometimes, like, oh, man, did you just say that?
Mm-hmm.
But I go, you know, we visited that church, and it's 10,000 tall, skinny Dutch people like me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not this really cutting-edge cultural sort of thing. Now, the service is, but what we've found is the Emergent Church tends to appeal most to burned-out evangelical areas. I mean, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if you got some Emergents here in Colorado Springs. You know, go to Wheaton, go to Westmont. I mean, it's where there are these evangelical bubbles that mm-hmm. I think kids grow up, maybe in, you know, watered down sort of churches, and they say, I want to be a Christian, but this isn't cool anymore. And they latch onto this, where we found in a place like Lansing or East, I mean, nobody goes to East Lansing for anything except maybe to go to school there. And most of our students, they feel like, you know what, I get the postmodern stuff in my classes. This mm-hmm. is not cutting edge. I want to hear what truth is. I want to get something solid. So because they're in that environment, I think the Emergent Church isn't as attractive.
Mm-hmm. And I think there has been kind of a backlash, too, to the whole mega church movement and what became
exactly.
big in the 80s and 90s now, and just kind of, people wanting to, those especially in my generation, who I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, who kind of were just thrown into youth groups, you know,
right.
and all of a sudden it just became this laser light show, and you're just kind of like, whoa, you're on overload. So, okay, so tell me, Kevin, what then is your real, what's your real problem with the Emergent Church? What, you know, what had to be said in this book that people need to know about?
Yeah. Okay, big question, not a lot of time. I'll just give a couple of things. Number one has to do with the knowability of God. See, the Emergents say, look, modernism was all about linear and rational and systematic theology, and now we're postmodern, so we got to move past this, and we got mystery and dialogue, and, you know, those words could be okay in a certain context. But what they often do is they have the immensity of God swallow up his knowability. I mean, the theologians call the transcendence and the immanence. And so they say, look, God is so far beyond us. What can we really know about God? And one of the taglines they use sometimes, they say, all theology is heresy. By that, they mean anytime we speak with of God in human language. He's so far above us that we're not really capturing him. And of course, that's true in a sense. We see through a glass darkly. But you get these irresponsible statements like the mystery is the truth, and that sounds more like Hinduism than Christianity. And it sounds like humility to say we can't really know God, but it undercuts his revelation that we have a God who speaks to people. I mean, the apostles didn't go around the Roman world saying, look, I got a God with a lot of cool paradoxes and just this mystery. I don't really understand him, but he's love. No, they said, look, you have a statue to an unknown God, which you worship as unknown. I'll declare to you. And so we can know something about God. And the other thing I'll just mention real quickly is probably the biggest concern that we found as we read, you know, 5,000 pages of these books and blogs was that they misunderstand the gospel. I'm always telling my congregation that the gospel is not, first of all, a message about what we can do for God, but a message about what God has done for us. And the gospel that comes across in so much of the emergent literature is a message, hey, look, go join Jesus' revolution, go change the world, go solve hunger and poverty, and they got a lot of good issues, but it's a message of imperative. Here's what you do. Mm-hmm. Come follow Jesus. Do what Jesus did, instead of a message of indicative, first of all, statements about here's what God has done for you. And so salvation becomes making the world a better place and not so much forgiveness for our sins.
Hmm. All right. So what would you say then to folks who, and I think I'd asked this when we talked with Tom Nevin about this several months ago now, and he was giving his take on it. For people that just don't know, and they're kind of out there trying to sift between, you know, what should they take, what should they leave, what are really the core principles, not only in looking for a church itself, but to really in just for a reasoned believer, a young adult who's just saying, I really do want to make an impact. I really do want to grow closer to the Lord. I want to find out about this Jesus. What are the core principles that they need mm-hmm. to be looking for?
Yeah, some of the questions that I think are helpful to ask as you're reading some of these books by these popular authors or as you're looking at a church. Number one, what is their view of the scriptures? Now, everybody's going to say they like the scriptures, so mm-hmm. you need to be discerning. Some of the emergents talk about, well, it's an honored conversation partner, or it has authority because the community affirms it. You want to see, are they willing to say, thus saith the Lord? Mm-hmm. And like Jesus says to the devil in Matthew 4, it is written. I mean, do they go to the scriptures manifestly, not just in a general way, but the preaching is manifestly coming out of the scriptures. Number two, I think you want to ask, what did the cross accomplish? Because that's where it really comes down to. What did the cross accomplish? And for so many of these folks, and it's all over evangelicalism, the cross is a good example, which it is, or it shows how much God loves us, or it shows how God suffers along with sufferers. But the gospel, first of all, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, is a message of historical fact that Jesus died according to the scriptures for our sins, that we might have new life. So you need to say, what did the cross do? It's more than just an example. It's more than just something that we imitate. Was Jesus' death actually a substitutionary sacrifice for our sins? Because that's what a lot of the emergents don't want to talk about. And it's a message that, I mean, it sells. It's hot. It'll work on Larry King and Oprah and at the Oscars to say, you know what? Christianity is just about following Jesus and forgiving people and, you know, getting rid of greenhouse gases or whatever mm-hmm. else your issues are, when the gospel from the very beginning of Matthew chapter 1 says Jesus came because he would die for the people's sins. I mean, they're called the gospels because the whole point of them is his death and resurrection, and that's what gets minimized in the emergent church. And mm-hmm. so that's what you need to look for is the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Without everything else thrown in or accommodated or, you know, well,
yeah, I mean, Brian McLaren says in one point that the stuff of our evangelistic tracts, God's free forgiveness for sins, is at best a footnote. That's his word, a footnote to a much more glorious gospel. Mm. So that's not what they're interested in. Mm. And that doesn't get to the scandal of the cross, which is our own sinfulness, our own need to repent. Instead, it just appeals to our desire to make the world a better place and get involved in social justice. But it doesn't get to the heart of what the human problem is, and that's our sinfulness.
That it is. All right, I've been talking with Kevin DeYoung. His book is Why We're Not Emergent by Two Guys Who Should Be. You can find out more about the book and about him and his co-author, Ted, at boundless.org. Go ahead and check it out there. And hopefully we can have you in conversation sometime in the future and get updates on that. So all the best out there in Michigan with the church and whatnot. So we will hopefully hear from you in the future. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For this week's Boundless Inbox, we have another question from a female. This time it's from Lindsay, and I have Candace with me here in the studio to address Lindsay's question.
Hi, Lindsay.
Yeah, and here we go. Lindsay says, it seems that when you write about marriage in America today, and I'm going to say she means you, Candace. We'll see how this plays out here.
That's not your shtick, Lisa.
No, I haven't done much writing on that so far. She says, you seem to imply that those of us who are not yet married are not married because that is what we have chosen. We prefer to delay marriage until later in life. And as a remedy to this, you give us all kinds of advice on how it's better to marry young, how to be more choosy about the people we date, how to filter through the lot of other singles out there to find a prospective mate, and how to have a correct point of view when dating. My question is this. What are we supposed to do when the opposite sex doesn't even seem to realize we're single and available? I am 28 years old and have never been on a date. I know lots of single guys. I put myself in appropriate situations in order to be around available guys and get to know them. I'm outgoing and interesting and feel like I have a lot to offer a potential mate. But for some reason that I cannot figure out, I have somehow managed to avoid being asked out by any man ever. Ever. Not once. Oh, other than the whole club bar insert any other unappealing means of meeting a man here scene, I don't know what to do. I have enjoyed my single existence, don't get me wrong, but I've enjoyed it because I try to make the most out of what life gives me. It is not by choice that I'm still single, but I don't know what else to do to even spark an interest. Is it possible that I am just undateable?
Lindsay, I'm so glad you wrote, and I just want to say that it makes me really thankful to know that there are women like you who aren't intentionally delaying marriage, because as you have pointed out, that is a problem that we talk about a lot. Let me just make sure, though, that you understand that we don't just talk about it because we're trying to slap that label on people. We really do see a trend in our culture of women making decisions in their early 20s that have the effect, whether they intend it to or not, of delaying marriage for them. And so this is a recognized problem that we're addressing. However, it's very possible that those articles don't apply to you. So let me suggest that you focus on a different aspect of what we do also on Boundless, and that is talking about mentoring. I think you're right that bars aren't a great place to meet guys, and I encourage you to continue that line of thinking. But I think it's time for you to enlist some help. And the best way to do that is to start seeking out through prayer and just making invitations to mentors. You would benefit so much from an older woman, and she doesn't have to be a grandmother. I mean, it could be someone who's just a couple of years further down the road, maybe a woman who's been married a couple of years, to go out for coffee with you and get to the point where you can ask her candidly, look, I've never been asked on a date. I do know a lot of good Christian single guys. Are there some blind spots I'm missing? Are there some things that I'm not aware of that make me quote unquote undateable? You may have some issues that aren't evident to you. I think we all bring some, you know, version of baggage, whether it's a little makeup case or a huge, you know, steamer trunk of issues into relationships. And so it would be really helpful to just get some objective feedback from somebody whom you trust, who is a godly, mature woman. And then once you've started to work through that with her, as she's helping you identify areas that may be blind spots, to then come up with a plan for how to start improving in those areas and to make yourself more appropriate. Maybe it's an attraction issue. Maybe it's a maturity issue. Maybe you send off signals that you love your single life so much that the guys in your life think you really aren't interested in a change of status. Whatever the case may be, you can start to come up with some action items with this mentor and then have some follow-up with her to see if you're making progress. At that point, I would say it's appropriate to ask her to help you by maybe hosting, you know, maybe she and her husband could host an event at their house and invite some of the guys you know, maybe someone you're interested in, and create opportunities to relate to them in a more relationship fostering environment.
I think, isn't it the story that you tell about the Morkans where really they orchestrated a lot to the point of just frankly sometimes telling, hey, or was it them or was it someone else that we've been talking about where literally people go up to, you know, a young man and they're like, have you considered so-and-so? Sometimes that's needed. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the Morkans. Maybe that's Scott Croft or a different church setting. But the way that the Morkans were helpful to me is that when I identified Steve as someone I thought would be a really great match for me, I went to Mary and talked through those desires with her, and she was able to give me candid feedback on how I was relating to him and what was appropriate and what wasn't. And then I said, well, let's have a dinner party, and why don't you come, and then I'll invite Steve. And of course, they were eager participants, willing participants. It would have been completely weird for me to just have Steve over for a quiet one-on-one dinner. But with the Morkans there, it changed everything. Steve was a student of Dr. Morkans, welcomed the opportunity to have, you know, time with his professor outside of class. And so I was creating an opportunity that was very appealing to Steve. And in the process, we had a chance to connect on a deeper level. With the Morkans, knowing that I was interested in him, asking some really good questions that got us thinking.
I think I'll just share quickly from my own experience, Lindsay, and that is I actually had someone come up to me not too long ago and tell, or it was a conversation I was having with a guy that I know, and he said something to the effect of, well, you know, you do kind of come across as though you have it all together. Like I wasn't, there wasn't like a vulnerability there, or it was just kind of, I used to fall into the trap of just being one of the guys, you know, I would kind of speak whatever they knew, you know, they could talk about, I would jump in and talk about that as well. There was really no differentiation between us. I think I've had to work on that a lot. And I also just want to encourage you, Lindsay, that, you know, you can drive yourself crazy trying to figure out all of your flaws and how you're going to fix them and whatever. I think at some point, you know, when you've done what you could and you've done what Candace said, you know, getting mentors and stuff, I always just say there's a time when you just have to give, this sounds so cliche, but literally give it back to the Lord and petition him and say, Lord, I don't know why this isn't working out. I don't know why this person or this person or this person who seems to be a great match for me, you know, isn't pursuing or isn't interested or whatever. And really, you know, truly God knows. And sometimes it's best to go back to him and take
well,
it
sometimes,
up with him.
Sometimes you do just have to relax because maybe you're giving off a vibe that you're so intense about it that you scare the guys away. That's a possibility too. I love the story that another one of my mentors shared that she was wanting to go to this big formal event. This was a couple of decades ago, so not that we have that many formals anymore, but she wanted to go to this formal event and needed a date, and she had met this young man who she really was attracted to, but she couldn't ask him to be her date because back then that would have been totally inappropriate, and it probably still would be today, but that's another Q&A. So she said to this young man, well, I'd really like to go to this event. Do you have any friends who are available? Because I'm looking for an escort. Yeah. And he came back and said, I'll take you.
Aww.
And it was just her way of signaling to him that she was vulnerable and interested.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, he had the, you know, the courage and the character to be aggressive and take the initiative. And they're married today and have, I don't know, like 12 grandkids and just a really great story. So
she is also savvy and resourceful, and we support
that.
Some would say sneaky, but I think it's good. It works.
No, strategic.
Strategic. Yeah. That's awesome.
Sneaky
strategic planning.
Sneaky is devious, and we're not, we don't want any deviousness.
But we support strategic planning
and
mission statements. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Candace, for addressing that. I'm sure Lindsay will find that beneficial. So that is it for the inbox this week and for the show itself. Again, write to us, editor@boundless.org. We want to hear from you. And until the next time around, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.